Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 114 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobolski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. I found that often when people in general think or talk about the people east of the Holy Land in the Middle Ages, there's one word that comes up right away: horde. Images abound of an unruly swarm of quote-unquote barbarians sweeping across quote-unquote civilization and murdering everyone in their path. This, like so many common ideas about the medieval world, is a simplistic and a skewed view of the Mongol people and of the horde itself. So I think it's about time we started to see them as they really were. This week, I spoke with the brilliant Dr. Marie Favreau about the Mongols, and specifically the Golden Horde. Marie is an associate professor of history at Paris-Nanterre University and the author of La Horde d'Or et le Sultanat Mamelouk, as well as a graphic novel called simply Genghis Khan. Marie's new book is called The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World, and it is just a wonderful readable book for both people who are already familiar with medieval history and those who are just at the beginning of their journey, especially when it comes to Mongol history. So, without further ado, let's jump right into learning about the Mongols, who they were, how their empire worked, and how they changed the world. Well, thank you for joining me, Marie. I'm so happy to see you. I love the book, and I'm so happy to have you here to talk about the Mongols and the Horde. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here with you, and I'll try to share everything.
Yeah, there is a lot to share. It's like I said, it's a great book and it's very detailed. And we're only going to get into some of that today. But let's start at the beginning. When people talk about the Middle Ages and they talk about the Mongols, who are they talking about?
Well, they are talking about a number of tribes, or let's say nomadic peoples, living in the early 13th century, end of the 12th century in East Asia, in the steppe, and also in the Tiberian forest belt in East Asia. And we see at the end of the 12th century, early 13th century, the name Mongol appear more in the sources, and those tribes start to be more active, or we see more of their action in the sources. So before that, it's hard to find a lot of information, especially on the Mongols. We have information on nomadic groups, but not specifically on Mongols before the 12th century. Not very much.
Is this a name that they gave themselves, or is this a name that was given to them by outsiders?
They use this name for themselves. They use also other names. It's more complicated when you get into it, but still, Mongols is like a political name. The name they give, it's more like a political name. And they can use other names, but Mongol remains very important. They use others like Tatars. Maybe you've heard of it, but Mongol will remain until late, even until the 15th, 16th centuries in certain parts of Central Asia, a key political term. And they are proud of it. And they want to be called Mongols.
Okay, good. I wanted to establish that just for my own sake, because I feel like it's very important to call people by the names that they call themselves.
I agree, absolutely, yes.
Thank you for that. And so your book is called The Horde, and that is a name that also was used by these people. So who are the Horde specifically, and when we talk about the Mongols?
So it's really the way we call the western part of the Mongol Empire. So the Mongol Empire reached really the Black Sea and almost the Mediterranean Sea. So let's say Eastern Europe, up to Eastern Europe. And there's a part that covered, let's say, Russia today, what is Russia today, and a big part of Kazakhstan too, a part of the Caucasus, and a part of Eastern Europe. So all this large, extremely large area was called Golden Horde, or just Horde. And I prefer to use Horde. So it's still the Mongol Empire, but the western part of it. So my book is not focused on China, for instance, or really on the eastern part of the Mongol Empire, but on the western part. That's why it's called The Horde instead of the UN Mongols or even the Mongol Empire.
Yes, because the empire, as you say, took up pretty much all of Asia. The huge,
absolutely. Huge. Yes, it's huge. Yes.
How did the Mongol Empire get established? Because I think we have this idea about a dude named Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
And you've corrected this, and please do correct us here. That's just bloodthirsty and he's taking over everything because the object was world domination. So can you tell us how the Mongol Empire actually was established?
It's true that in a way, everything started with Genghis Khan. The name, the title Genghis Khan, which means like extremely powerful emperor, in 1206. And before that, he was very active in the Eastern Steppe. He, in a way, unified the Mongol groups there, the nomadic tribes. And after 1206, he starts what we call the conquest of the world. We exaggerate when we say that. Actually, he conquered mainly northern China and a part of Central Asia. And the rest of Eurasia up to Eastern Europe and up to Korea in the east was conquered by his successors, who were all his sons and great sons. So the period of the conquest itself lasts for a century. It's, you can imagine that it starts in the beginning of the 13th century and it ends at the end of the 13th century. So that's the period of the conquest. But during the conquest period, there was already a form of administration. It's already a form of colonization. So the empire starts before the end of the conquest period. So we tend to separate, you know, a conquest time of, you know, wars and then a time of peace and organization. But it's not correct, in fact. We have to consider the period as a whole. And we have to understand that even during conquest, it's not only about violence and war. There are also administration, reorganization. And during the time after the conquest, like in the 14th century, we have also important moment of even of violence, so it's not really peace, but still there are also constructions, forms of religious toleration, and I can talk about that later. So let's think about this period as almost two centuries, a century and a half. And in the case of the Horde, so in the Western part, we can go up to the 15th century. That's what I show in the book too.
Absolutely. So I do want to emphasize that we shouldn't call this man Genghis Khan, we should call him Genghis Khan, right? And so he established his lineage. So what was the importance of his lineage when we're talking about that legacy, that administration, that change in the Horde and the Mongol Empire as time goes on? What was the impact of that bloodline?
Well, extremely important. Thank you for this question because it's a key thing. So this lineage was called the, what's it called in a way, the golden lineage. And it's the imperial lineage and it's the only lineage that could provide rulers. We call them Khan or Great Khan. So the male lineage is key in the organization of the empire. And that's something that will remain to the end. If there can be several candidates to the throne, but they have all to be descendant, direct male descendant of Genghis Khan. And that's something also that was new because probably Genghis Khan's lineage was one of the important lineage among the nomads before the 13th century. But after him, after he died in 1227, it was the lineage. There were other lineage, but they were not as important as Genghis Khan's lineage.
Yes. And when they took over, they had a lot of strategies for making sure that other factions and other families didn't try and rebel against them. So what were some of the ways that they, you talk about this a lot in the book as being important. They didn't just conquer. They didn't just slaughter. They assimilated. Yeah. So how did that work when they conquered people?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the idea of, well, the idea of my book is really to focus on the Mongol regime. I wanted to show that it was a very interesting and complex regime, very supple in many ways, with some rigid aspects. So the rigid aspect is, for example, the fact that there's just this lineage. There's just one lineage. You cannot, you know, if you want to have a ruler, it has to be from this lineage. So that's a rigid aspect. But then the state is open for the administration, the staff, the merchants. It's very ethnically and religiously open. So they would hire people from everywhere among their subject, direct subject, among the sedentary people, but it can be also among neighbors. So they would hire Italian people. The most famous perhaps is Marco Polo, who was hired, in fact, not really as a merchant, but more as a messenger. in China by Kublai and by the Great Khan. So the idea was really to open certain part of the administration, certain part of the highest level of the societies to everybody, or to, let's say, skilled people, skilled craftsmen, wealthy religious men from everywhere, but at the same time to forbid them to enter, for instance, the ruling lineage. So they play on both in an amazing way, something even I discovered when I worked on this. I didn't expect that because I don't think that it was really searched before. So it's the idea of this regime. It's really absorption, being supple, and at the same time, being really extremely rigid on certain aspects.
Yes. I do have one more question about the lineage before I move on. And that is, so a lot of the Khans had multiple wives. So when we're talking about lineage, does it have to be directly from one marriage, or is it from all of them?
Well, it's a very, very important question, actually. Mostly, well, there are several wives, but one is the primary wife or the chief wife, and only the children by this primary wife were allowed to be candidate for the throne and to be successors. But in certain cases, important secondary wives were able also to provide influential princes and even, you know, strong candidates for the throne. So let's say that the woman played extremely important role in the Mongol Empire, a political role. They have a lot of weight in many ways. They have their own wealth, and they also try to push their sons, of course, and their daughters as well. The princesses are also important. But yet, there's this notion of primary wife or chief wife that would remain up to the end. That also something that you have to take into account. And I really worked on that in the book as well.
Mm-hmm. It's important to find the place of women in history always. Yeah. Have assumptions about what their place is, and they're not always right. Now, there's that brings me to this one. It's funny at a distance. It wouldn't have been funny at the time. That instance where the Mongols tried to make peace with the Mamluks through marriage, and it really ended up being a disaster because they both didn't understand what the terms were. So, can you tell us a bit about that incident? Because I thought it was funny with hindsight, with distance.
Yeah, it's absolutely. So it's interesting to see that. So as you know, during the Middle Ages, it was kind of normal thing to provide princesses for diplomatic reasons. It's very common for the Byzantines, for instance. But the Mongols are a bit different. The Mongols, they don't send their daughters a far away. They don't like that. They could marry foreign princesses, but they don't like to send their daughters far away. They usually prefer to marry their daughters to subject people, like important subject kings. For instance, Russian princes were married to Mongol princes. But at some point, the Mamluk, so the Sultan of Egypt and Syria, were a strong allied of the Mongol in the West, or of the Horde, ask for a Mongol bride. And that was something new. Before they had exchanges, they were allied, and they would exchange also scholars, craftsmen, but not women. So in the Horde, they were really puzzled, and it took them a lot of time to agree, in fact, because they were afraid of, you know, the situation. They were wondering how she would be, you know, welcomed and everything. So at the end, they agree, but they ask a lot of money in exchange, which means that they valued a lot their princess, the Mongol princess. And the Mamluks were shocked because they saw that it was really a lot of money, and they were forced. So the Mamluk ambassadors was forced to borrow money from the Khan's merchant, from the Mongol merchants, to pay for the bride price, actually. Then she was sent to Egypt. And there, soon after, we don't know if she didn't get along with the Sultan or if he had other wives. So we don't know exactly what happened. But then she divorced. But she stayed in Egypt, and she was remarried to a local emir. And she had a good situation probably there. But the Mongol ruler was extremely unhappy because he heard that she was not queen anymore, or she was not married with the sultan anymore. And he complained. And at that point, the Mamluk sultan said, no, well, she disappeared, she died, and we don't know where she is. And he lied completely in the face of the Mongol, who was even more unhappy. And so it was a big diplomatic failure, in fact, at the end. Even if they were allied, the Mamluks and the Mongols, even if in both cases, both society at this point were Muslim, the way they dealt with high society women were very different. Yeah, that's very interesting to see that in the sources. A bit of funny anyway. Yeah, that's true. But you know that the tombstone of the Mongol princess, it's still visible in Cairo today. She has her own monuments. Yeah, there. And I've been there, so I saw it and said, amazing how, you know, this Mongol history sort of cross borders, you see.
Yes, and I love that it's still there. That was probably an apology, I'm sure. I liked how you said in the book where the Mongols ask for all this money, and as you say, you know, only give the princesses to people who are their subjects. And so they're like, does this mean you're our subjects now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for them, it was clear that the Mamluk sultan was like a subject. It's true. So, and the Mamluk thought, no, I'm not an equal. That's why I want the Mongol princess. So it's, yeah, total nonsense.
But you touched on religion a moment ago. So let's dig into that, because I do think that's really important. So again, there's this misconception that the Mongols are sweeping across Asia. They're wiping everyone out. They're just being totally a steamroller in some ways, just flattening everything. But when it comes to culture and when it comes to religion, they actually have a huge range of tolerance in their society. So what was the place of religion in Mongol society? And we can stick to the horde if you like, because the empire is so big.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's really something that is common to all the Mongol rulers everywhere in the Mongol Empire. So and it started with Genghis Khan. We know already that under Genghis Khan, he made sort of agreement and contract, especially with the Muslim in Central Asia. And so these agreements are called Darkhan or Tarkhan or Tarkhan. And they mean that the elite religious men were protected by the Mongols as long as they pray for them, as long as they support them, in fact. And this protection more precisely included a tax exemption. So huge advantage, financial advantage, so tax exemption, and also they were not supposed to do the conscription, so they were protected from wars. And this system was established first probably for the Muslims under Genghis Khan, and then for the Taoists also at the same time. And after that, it was also established for the Buddhists, for the Christians, and for the Jewish people too. And that's what I saw for the Horde, at least. It's clear that all these religions were protected in the sense that the priests, the clergies were protected and were recognized, institutionally recognized by the Mongols. And that's also explained why, even though we know that there were destruction in the mid-13th century, very quickly after that, in the second half of the 13th century, in Russia, for instance, they start building again and building churches, monasteries, but they were building also in the steppe Muslim schools, hammam, so baths, public baths, a lot of structures that were financed through this system. Because of the tax exemption, they had cash, actually. And so the religious communities would build. And that's something also that I discovered during my work on the Horde. And I saw that it could explain this sort of contradiction between the destruction of the Mongols at the very beginning of the conquest, and then very soon after, the flourishing of the economy and the flourishing of several thousands of communities in Central Asia and Eastern Asia too. That's something very specific to the Mongol at a time when a ruler had to be either Muslim, Christian, or Buddhist. For long, the Mongols would be in the Horde. For instance, we have cases where you can see that probably there were the three of them. I mean, they didn't care. As soon as the rituals would work, as soon as the priests would support them, they would be open and they could be baptized and take also a Muslim name at the same time. So it's still, again, this process of absorption that we mentioned, social absorption, but also with religions. And at the same time, up to the end, I show in the book that they kept lively their steppe culture and their belief in Tengri, the sky, so the most important god or deity, if you prefer, of the nomads. Still, they will keep all these beliefs even after the 15th century.
Yeah, and this flexibility gives them a lot of benefits when it comes to trade, because they are able to trade with the Sultanates and they're able to trade with the Christians as well.
You're absolutely right. Exactly. So that will be useful, because they don't really mind. They don't select people on the basis of, you know, ethnicity or religion or language. So that's also where they are very supple, and also it's part of their strengths. Yeah.
Yeah. And I see this. You had a couple of cases in the book where they played the religions off each other. I don't remember which Khan it was, but they were upset with the Mamluks at one point. So they told the Christians that the Mamluks were selling slaves that were Christian children. And so they played them off of each
Absolutely.
Other until they
yeah,
got what they
yeah.
wanted.
Oh, yeah. No, they are very political. You know, I don't know if I can say it that way, but it's true that they perfectly understand how also when they wanted to play a community against another, they know how to do that, of course. Absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the arguments that you make in the book is that the great strength of the Mongol Empire and the Horde especially is that they are nomadic. And I really appreciate how you mention in the epilogue especially that this is a choice. It's not a phase of civilization that they're still stuck in. This is a choice that they make. But you mentioned cities just now. So what's the relationship between this nomadic people and this nomadic group of, I don't know how we want to say it, as a court or as a political group that's really still always on the move, and these cities that you're saying are building up in
yes.
the empire? What's the relationship between the nomads and their cities?
Yeah, thank you very much. This is also, yeah, it was almost the starting point of my book, because I worked also with friends and colleagues who are all interested in nomadic empires, and it's a fascinating shape of power. So really, it's a specific regime. So they play on the fact that they are very mobile. But you could say that at the same time in Western Europe, rulers were mobile too. Then they moved. So the Mongols yeah. move differently. They have a predictable way of moving, and they move along big rivers. That's also something I wanted to show in the book, to show that there's this seasonality of movement and there's predictable movement. So you know where to, a nomad would know where to find the courts, the mobile courts, but probably a sedentary person would be puzzled and maybe would have trouble to find them. So that's interesting. But also, they have a system with their own city, which are called also hordes. So those cities are actually the Khan's camp, the ruler's camp, for instance, or a nobleman camp. And it's huge. There are also households. So it's full of women and children. There are craftsmen who followed, were in the horde. So these are mobile cities, and they moved along the rivers. So they go also south during wintertime, and they go north during summertime. And next to that, they also have, either they were cities before, even in the steppe, or they built or financed building normal cities, like regular cities. The only thing they want is that those cities shouldn't have walls or, let's say, very small defensive construction. So they don't like towers and stuff like that, because they see that as something, you know, aggressive. So cities should be open. That's what they want. But then after that, they would really put a lot of money and effort into cities. And that's also something perhaps some people know, but most of the people think that nomads are against cities. And it's really interesting to see how, in fact, they were not against cities. They were not against agriculture, neither. So that it was very benefit for the empire. And also, you know, because they absorb also economic differences. So they're also happy to see cities developing. But at the same time, something I show in the book, when they have troubles, when they have political troubles or, you know, more ecological troubles, they could leave a city. They could just drop it. Then you see they are nomads. They don't care so much. They would not stay in a city to protect it at the very up to the end. It's not like they don't have something like Rome. No, so they can leave a city, because most important for them is humans, people, like, you know, people, really. So that's where you see the wealth of a ruler. It's how many people, how many subjects, not really how many cities, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah, and you do mention that in terms of warfare, where they won't spend a whole bunch of resources on a siege. That's not important to them. They will find that leader, no matter where that leader is, and they'll capture the leader.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things that I hadn't even thought of before looking at the book is you have a nomadic people. They have their own spiritual beliefs about who the land belongs to. But we also have people that are conquered people. They're sedentary people. They have their own traditions about who owns the land. So how did they figure out how to distribute land? How did they do that when it came to laws? Well,
that's a very important question. That's also a difficult topic to work on. But I tried really to analyze at least one or two cases in connection with the Russian principalities. So the Russian sedentary way of, you know, owning the land and the Mongol way. So they don't see the landscape the same way, for sure. But at the same time, they were really able to sit at the table in a way and discuss and find a common ground. I think that they understood that they perceived a land differently, especially for the Mongols owning like rivers or, you know, water. It makes absolutely no sense. So they had, really like issues about that. But the Mongols at the same time have a very strong written culture. They are even themselves issuing written contracts even for ownership. And they would, with the Russian, try to find a common language in a way to set up properties. Still, they understand properties differently, but they understand the idea of having a territory, for instance. What you see actually is really negotiations. And that's something I wanted to show in the book because it's really run through several centuries. And I wanted to see how this system was created and developed and how all those negotiations at the end made this system so rich and interesting. And in the Horde, it's kind of different, I think, in the East, but in the Horde, the negotiation was rather, I would say, peaceful, even with the Russian. There were also moments of a lot of tension. But yet, if you consider all the differences, cultural differences, you know, different language, a different religion, at the level of human history, it's a peaceful period. It's a peaceful period, yes, between very different peoples.
Yes, it always depends on who you ask. When you zoom out, it is a period where things were working, it seems.
Exactly, yeah. So I think in that sense, it's kind of fascinating. A lot of negotiation and also face-to-face negotiations. They have meetings. They have regular meetings. They ask the Russian to come to the Khan's court. So they know themselves at the end. In the 14th century, clearly, they are not strangers.
Yeah, I like that. You mentioned it in the book as well, where the Khan say, "We don't go to you. You come to us. It doesn't matter where we are. If you need something, you come and see us."
Exactly.
You can tell where the power is. But you mentioned writing just now. And I think that's super important because when you have nomadic people, there might be an assumption that they have no writing or that we can't access it or that they're too primitive or something like that. But a large part of your research was based on writing. So how did you research the Horde? What did you look at?
Well, absolutely. So first, I looked at the written sources because I'm a historian, and also because this is something, it's so rich with the Mongol. They produced written documents already under Genghis Khan. So Genghis Khan himself decided that the Mongol should be written. He asked a secretary to use the Uyghur scripts to write Mongol, oral Mongol language at that time. And then after that, the Mongol would use other languages too. Of course, a different form of Turkish language, but also Persian. They would use Chinese, of course. They would use Arabic language, also Latin. And also there were some translation into Italian and, you know, other languages. So it's really an empire in that sense. And that's one of the definition of empires, is multiple ways of governing. For the Horde, my point was first using the chancellery documents. So most of them were written in Turkish, but in Arabic script. I used also translation of those documents, contemporary translations, especially, as I said, so in Italian, some in Persian as well, and in Russian. I used then a lot of coins. There were plenty of coins that were preserved from the Mongol period, and they have all those funny, they are funny because they are all different, and you have all those inscriptions. And so I wanted to use the coins not only for the economic system, but also to show their belief system or the way they express sovereignty and power. So coins were also very important. I also try to use as much as I can material culture. So burials, objects, monuments, of course. So I had to travel there, so mainly to Russia and Central Asia, to see the places, so that it was very important to see the landscapes, to see the rivers. It's very important when you work on, especially on the Horde and probably on the whole Mongol Empire, that you combine those different type of sources. Even if you're a historian and not art historian, archaeologist, you have to dig into the material culture. Talk to colleagues who are more expert on that, that's fine, but it's very important because with nomads, it's important, you understand a lot of things through the material culture. And if I can give one example of that, so in the Horde, several rulers converted to Islam very publicly, and also very early in the 13th century. So there was this idea that the Horde was a kind of Muslim state within the Mongol Empire. And with material culture and, you know, burial excavations, you realize that the Islamic part of this culture is not so important. It's not the only one, for sure. There are a lot of Christian objects. There are also Jewish monuments. And they were also like polytheists, you know, shamanist objects. And so it's not only about Islamic culture, or it's Islamic culture with a mix of a lot of other things. So this is something you perceive very clearly with the object and not so clearly through the documents and through the coins, because on the coins you have a lot of Islamic inscriptions. So it's kind of hard in a way, because all those documents, they contradict each other sometimes. It's funny, but at the same time, it's very exciting.
You've made such good points here, because written sources are super important, of course, but they're written for a certain audience. They're written with an agenda in mind. And while that's also true of the material culture, you need to have both of these things to try and see where the balance is.
Exactly.
Because, because people are trying to sell you on one story or another at the time. And so you have to figure out what the whole picture is. And as you've said here and in the book as well, when their cities are not built to last, then you don't have the cities to read. So you have to look at burials and coins and things like that.
Thank you. That's absolutely true. I completely agree. I mean, my students are sometimes surprised because they think that medievalists would work only in the archives. And I say, no, you also have some time to go and see the landscape and travel far away, depending on, you know, on your topic. But if you work on the Mongol Empire, you have to go to certain areas and see the places, see the burials, see the mountains, see the rivers. That's also part, actually, of your sources.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're dealing with nomads, I think, as you say, where we might have a mental picture of them just going across plains on horses. But as you say, they're river people as well, and you need to have an understanding of what it would have been like to travel that much and with that big of a group. Hard to imagine these days, I think.
Yeah, of course. I agree. You have to try to forget, you know, but in certain areas, in the steppes, it's easy because there are not so many cars, and, you know, there are mosquitoes sometimes everywhere in spring, and you just close your eyes and you know where you are, and you what they might have felt. I don't know. It's funny.
Yeah. Mosquitoes have a way of bringing you back several hundred years.
Yeah. And then you understand why they move, you see, because.
Yeah. Why they're always trying to outrun the mosquitoes. Totally get that. I've been there. You've mentioned Russia a few times, and Russia has a big part to play in this, although they don't always like to acknowledge that in their history from what you've said. I don't know a lot about Russian history, but you said that they kind of downplay that. But at the time when the Russians are establishing themselves, especially after, we're talking 15th century, I think you're saying, they are leaning on the Mongols for their legitimacy. They're leaning on the Horde for their legitimacy. And that's really also based, you can see this also in their language when they choose Tsar as their word for the person in charge. So can you tell us a little bit about how Russia developed out of this relationship with the Horde? Just briefly.
Of course. Well, yes, I think that we always use the term Russia, even for the Middle Age, to sometimes because it's easier, and I do it sometimes. But there were several principalities, and it was really fragmented. During the Mongol period, these principalities were integrated into the empire, and they were forced to unify more than before because they had to levy taxes for the Mongols, and they had to agree among themselves on this process. So in a way, the Mongol forced the Russians to unify administratively. So it's not a total unification at all, but still, for the Mongol, they were one group. So that's one thing. The other thing is, especially on the Volga, they had connection with the Muslim world before the Mongols. It's only during the Mongol period that the Russian really developed economically and became really part of the big Eurasian game. And they integrated fully the Islamic trade networks, because that was the Mongol, you know, idea also, that to open doors and integrate them. And that's also why the horde is, I think, very important, because it showed how the Mongol worked on the integration of the north of Eurasia and the Russian, not only the Russian, but and the Russian, and into a bigger market and to a form of globalization, actually. And on that, I think really the Russian were, it was really a very useful period for the Russian in that sense. And in many ways, they flourished at that time. And that's clear if you look at the monuments, if you look at the written production also. But of course, the difficult thing, there was a huge rewriting of chronicles, Russian chronicles, in the 16th century and 17th century. So in these late sources or late version of all earlier sources, the Russian looked like very negative regarding the Mongol, and very, it was like they were at wars all the time. But actually it was not the case, and they had a good understanding in many ways. That's something important, because it explains why the horde lasts so long. I mean, the Mongols in this area stayed much longer than in other areas, like in, you know, northern China, for instance, because the Russian benefited, at least a part of the elite, Russian elite, benefited a lot, especially in Moscow, from the Mongol power and the form of the Mongol power. That's something really I wanted to show in the book. Although the book is not about Russia, but still, I wanted to make this relationship clear and as much as I could. So there's probably more to say, but I would be so happy if we could have more writing on this, because it's a fascinating period of Russian history.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's always more that we want in terms of more history being done. But it occurs to me that there is one more place where we have to redeem the Mongols' reputation, and that is around the Black Death. So I do think that we need to be careful when we talk about plague transmission and stuff, because we don't want to blame anyone. I do think it's interesting how you talk about how some of the fur trade and how some of the gathering of animals that could have had this bacterium on them, that might have been part of a contributing factor. And also the way that they were hunting the predators, I think that's very interesting as well. And I don't know if we have time to get into that, but the Mongols are blamed for a siege in which they are said to have spread the Black Death to the Mediterranean. Yeah. So can we clear that up? Can we redeem
Absolutely,
the Mongols
here? Yes. So this is, so first of all, I have to say that this is thanks to the work of my fantastic colleagues, Monica Green and Hannah Barker as well, who really published fantastic articles, research articles on the Black Death, on this period. And also in my own research, I came to the same conclusion, that it was really strange story about the Mongol during the siege who dropped plague-infected corpse into the Italian ranks to spread the plague. First of all, I've read these kind of stories for earlier period in other contexts. So it was clearly a topos. And also, thanks to Hannah Barker's work too, it was clear that the plague did not enter Italy and Europe after this siege. I think what is important actually is how, in fact, it's clear that the plague was already there in the Mongol Empire since more than a century, since perhaps the beginning. And I really wanted to work on how the Mongol coped with it, how they dealt with it. and how the European couldn't, because that's what happened at the end, that the European were completely overwhelmed and they couldn't, they didn't know how to react, really. While the Mongol had their own ways and they had their own way to deal with disease, so they were more prepared. And that's also another clue that shows that probably it was there before, well before. The other important point for me was to show that if the Mongol Empire started to collapse, it was not directly because of the Black Death, of the plague, but more because Europe suffered from it. And because Europe was one of the important partners, one of the main partners of the Mongols, then the Mongols had trouble to sort of adapt themselves to the new situation with this weak neighbor suddenly. I really wanted to work on that period also because it resonates today. And then I saw that it was interesting to see how the Mongol decided rather to live with it than to fight, because at that time, how you didn't even know where it was coming from and everything. So, yeah. But I think that we're going to have even more studies on this plague pandemic of the 13th, 14th century. And then we're going to have even more, I hope, information through archaeology on how the Mongols react to it and where it was developed in the empire, the ways it spread. But it's still, we have to be extremely careful on that point. And I think Monica Green made it very clear that the ways it spread, it's a big question and it's not as simple as it looked like at first sight.
Yeah, it's nowhere near settled how the plague spread. And I said this before, but I really think it's important that we don't put this all on the Mongols. I think it's easy to do. And I think that's because people were doing it at the time. So like all the historians that have referred back to the same source, you know, that's a source at the time, but that doesn't mean that we need to keep referring to that source. And I think that your book is a step in that direction. And I told you this before we started recording, but I just absolutely love this book. I think everyone should read it. And especially if you know nothing about the Mongols to begin with, it's a great place to start. And just congratulations on the book. It's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Really, when I was writing this book, I thought about all the like students and friends wanted to learn on the Mongols who had no previous knowledge. But at the same time, because I'm also like a researcher, I wanted to give them last stage of research, not, you know, the usual soup, but something really, because they deserve to know where we are now, where we stand now, you know, in terms of research on the Black Death or on the Mongols and on the connection with Russia. And that, I think, will generate new debates. And I have now a lot of question and reaction, and it's really nice. I'm so happy.
I can tell. I can definitely tell that this is work that you love. And I love how you've said that people deserve to know where we are now. I mean, I'm definitely on the same page with you. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
To find out more about Marie's work, you can visit her academia.edu page at u-paris10.academia.edu/Marie Favreau. Her book is The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World. And I highly recommend it. I also want to send a quick bonjour et bienvenue to Marie's students at Paris Nanterre, who sometimes are encouraged to listen to the Medieval podcast in order to help them work on their English. Thank you for inspiring me to have the courage to work on my rusty French. Et j'espère que ce podcast est utile pour vous. Before we go, here's Peter from Medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey, we have a new series starting this week. It's going to take a look at the medieval scribe and how, like, for like 1,000 years, he was the influencer, creating and changing manuscripts, making texts, changing them, doing ideas, helping things go viral, medieval viral.
I had never thought of scribes as influencers, but, you know, I think there's something to be said for it.
Is brought to us by Shari Boots. Some of you might remember she did a series on us like a couple years ago on St. Augustine in the Middle Ages and how he was received. Now she and her team at Radbound University like are co-writing these articles. So they talked to me a couple months ago about this idea. So I really like about 10 posts that they're going to create over the next 10 months. Just talking ways that scribes influence and change texts and medieval manuscripts. So a lot of fun. I always love looking at medieval manuscripts.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice that this is being done as a team effort. That's awesome.
Yeah. So we've got that. Plus, we've got pieces on how large were families in the Middle Ages and why you get bunions if you wear medieval footwear.
Oh, yeah, that was all over the news. I'm going to have to read that article more in depth.
What we do for fashion.
Yes. There's something I realized that we didn't mention before, and that is that my articles are actually getting translated. Like, speaking of people changing text for more audiences, my 5-Minute Medievalist articles, at least some of them, are being translated into Spanish on medievalist.net, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. A person has volunteered to write these pieces into Spanish. And yeah, we've got like about a dozen now up. So if you're in Latin America, Spain, and you want to read in Spanish, yeah, check out Danielle's work.
Yeah, they're being translated by, and I'm not sure I'm going to say her name right, because I've only seen it in email, but Pilar Espatilla is doing the translation. So thank you so much, Pilar, for doing these translations for us. And everyone can find 5-Minute Medievalist stuff in Spanish, which I think is quite awesome.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your support each month. You make this all possible, so you always have my thanks. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of great stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. It's that time again. Time to get yourself registered for the summer session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. This is a 6-week online class that I put together with a bunch of really amazing experts to help people creating medieval fiction get those nitpicky details they need without having to spend hours looking. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing to textile work, and we do it all with helpful videos, bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. You can even ask me anything. The next class begins Friday, July 9th. For all the details, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from battles to bunions, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which comes out October 12th. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.